So it's really terrific to be here. I have not been at every one of these, but I try to come every year to the extent I can. The NFB has just created such an important space for the development of both a community of disability rights lawyers and the ideas of disability rights law. I mean, I think this is a place where a lot of the disability law of the next 20 years gets hatched, and you know we've seen that over time. It's been terrific, you know, to think about the various ideas that got bandied about in this room and in the other rooms of this building during this symposium, and what has actually happened with them. And I, you know, will sometimes read in the law reports about a case and say, oh yeah, I remember when that was an embryonic idea. At the Ten Brooks Symposium, so it's really great to be here, and it's great to be talking about this topic. I think this is the most thematic Ten Brook meeting that I've ever been to. I mean, there's a really consistent theme in a lot of the presentations, which is, you know, thinking about taking that constitutional principle of equal concern and regard and the constitutional requirement of equal protection of the laws, and thinking about how do we apply that in the context of disability, and how has our legal system applied it well or not in the context of disability. I think Dr. Maurer's presentation really teed this up very nicely for us. You know, the equal protection of the laws was a central object of Jacobus Ten Brook's own study and writing. You know, he was a leading scholar of so many things and a leading activist and sort of the model of the engaged scholar. But one of his very central scholarly projects was actually unearthing and writing about the original meaning of the 14th Amendment. He was an originalist before people talked about originalism, and the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, what he got from that was, what he got into with that was an extensive study of the legal thinking of abolitionist lawyers in the period prior to the Civil War, and showed how their thought informed their understanding of, and the understanding of the drafters of the 14th Amendment. So I think this is just exceptionally important and appropriate to have this conversation at this symposium. What I want to talk about, I do think Dr. Maurer's done a great job of kind of teeing up the what's wrong, right? And so I will heed the advice to not talk so much about the ways in which the legal system and the courts have provided unequal protection in the context of disability. And I really want to talk about the question Dr. Maurer focused us on, which is, what do we do about it, right? And I think a lot of the conversations today are going to be about that. And let me just offer my views about that, and hopefully we can have some discussion here, and maybe it'll tee up some discussion later on in the conference. So I like to think about this in sort of two categories of questions, and it's, they're pretty straightforward questions, right? What do we want, and who's our audience, right? When we're thinking about taking the constitutional principle of equal protection and giving it real meaning as applied to disability in the context of disability, I think we want to really focus on, what do we want out of that, aside from, you know, the very highfalutin and abstract idea that, you know, equal protection applies to everybody? Can we get more concrete? And in thinking about trying to give this some meaning, how do we get there? And how we get there, I think, really requires, at least in the immediate term, a focus on who it is that we're talking to. Who are the folks who we're trying to persuade, and how are we trying to persuade them? So first, what do we want? And my bias here, as I said, is to think about this really in terms of concrete, substantive outcomes, not in terms of abstractions, right? I mean, the disability rights movement in America has always been a social movement that had a lot of ideas. It's been a deeply theorized social movement. One of the great things about the disability rights movement is it's, you know, people who have disabilities coming together and thinking really hard about what's wrong with the world and trying to change it. But the thinking really hard and the theorization has always been in service of concrete substantive outcomes. And so I want to kind of follow that tradition in my discussion. So what are the concrete outcomes that we want? Do we want a change in the constitutional doctrine, right? So Dr. Maurer went through a bunch of Supreme Court cases that fail to provide people with disabilities the same protections of equality that other folks get, and that fail to require state actors to protect the rights of disabled individuals in the same way that state actors protect other people. Do we want changes in that constitutional doctrine? And, you know, there are sub-questions we can ask. Do we want to challenge in the Garrett decision the idea that disability-based discrimination is subject to the lowest level of constitutional scrutiny, right? That's a very specific constitutional doctrine question, one that many people are asking. Do we want to challenge the lack of a constitutional basis for decisions like the Olmstead decision, which is the Brown v. Board of the disability rights movement, but is it based on interpretation of a statute? I mean, not even interpretation of statute, interpretation of a regulation interpreting a statute, right? So do we want that? And so what I want to ask about that is, what would changing these constitutional doctrines, or what would putting some of these doctrines on a constitutional basis as explained by courts get us? And I think that's a question that needs to be engaged. So there, the question has to be, as a concrete matter, what would change in the world if courts did this? We also might want to have a broader change in the understanding of what our Constitution is about. I mean, so this is a project I've engaged in somewhat in academically, thinking about taking Jacobus Ten Broeck's ideas about equal protection, abolitionist equal protection, and saying, why can't we make that more of a centerpiece of the way people think about the Equal Protection Clause, both with regard to disability and generally. And again, you know, that's at a very high level of abstraction. That's really a question of how we think about the Constitution. And I want to think hard about what might one actually get out of that. Maybe what we want to get closer to the ground is we want changes in institutional practices of governmental and private actors. Maybe that's what we want. So what we want to do is we want to eliminate the practices of that lead to segregation in society for people with various kinds of disabilities, right? So we want to challenge things like sheltered workshops and segregated day wasting programs for people who have various disabilities. We want to challenge the rise in hate crimes against people with disabilities. We want to challenge police use of force against disabled people, which is tremendously disproportionate to other use of force incidents. We want to challenge an issue that has arisen recently, raising very, very seriously the question of, are disabled people thought of as full and equal members of our community? Is in the discussion about closing the borders, right? There's an effort by many people who are allied with the Trump administration, that the Trump administration may run with, say that disability is a reason why we might not want to admit people. And we have, for a long time, actually, you know, owing in significant part to the eugenicist ideas that Dr. Maurer talks about, we have for a long time had disability floating around questions of immigration, right? For many years, medical conditions that today we'd call disabilities were just categorical reasons for inadmissibility. But that, like many other things, has changed as the disability rights movement has gained force. We may be seeing a regression in that. So do we want to change that? Are those things that we want? And if those are things that we want, how does a strategy of talking about constitutional equal protection change things, affect things? So I'll say, you know, my bias Is that it's really important to start with questions like this that are on the ground questions. And I'll explain why. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One is I think you can have a lot of fights about abstractions. I think it's important to have a sense of goals, to have a sense of what it is you're aiming for. But I also think it's important not to be detained by fights over things that are really, really questions in the air. But also, and I think this is one of the points that I want to make throughout the rest of this talk, it's about a theory of constitutional change. How does the Constitution in America change? And you know, we know we have a constitutional amendment provision. There's a process for amending the Constitution. The Constitution's been amended 27 times. Often those amendments have come in bursts, right? So we have right after the founding, we have the Bill of Rights, we have the 11th Amendment, the 12th Amendment, pretty close to the founding. We have the Reconstruction Amendments, 13th, 14th, 15th. We have the amendments of basically the progressive era, right? So income tax, women getting the right to vote, direct election of senators, prohibition, then getting rid of prohibition. You know, and we have the amendments that were associated with the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement. Right, so we have the poll tax amendment, we have the DC vote amendment. So we these often come in bursts, but for the most part, we don't have formal amendments of the Constitution. Right, there are other constitutional systems that do. We don't. That's not mostly how our Constitution changes. Mostly, how our Constitution changes is, you might say, through judicial decisions, like what Dr. Maurer was talking about. And that's true in a significant way, right? I mean, so the 14th Amendment's text didn't change between Plessy v. Ferguson and Brown v. Board. What changed was, what changed at the level of the court is, after Plessy, separate but equal was constitutional, was a proper understanding of the 14th Amendment. And after Brown, it was not anymore. First in schools, and then the court made clear very shortly thereafter in anything else that was a public activity. But there's something even deeper than that, which is, how did that constitutional change happen? How did the constitutional change in getting from Plessy to Brown, how did the constitutional change in any of the sorts of constitutional change that we talk about in a significant way, how does that happen? And my view, and it's the view of, you know, a lot of scholars of the Constitution, is that constitutional change really happens from the bottom up. Constitutional change does not happen from just people filing cases and getting into the Supreme Court and convincing the justices that, you know, five justices, that this is what the Constitution means. That is the end of the process. That's the thing that we all talk about. But what really makes constitutional change is both movements like the disability rights movement organizing, protesting, pressuring, creating a sense of movement in the world, but also their successes at various levels before we get to courts at all and before we get to the Supreme Court. It's changes in institutional practices in the world. It's changes in the way that other leading government agencies or lower courts think about issues that are in the same orbit as the constitutional change they're trying to make. Right? That's how constitutional change happens. So that suggests to me that if we're thinking about a strategy here, and I think it's incredibly important to be focused on the question for the next 10, 20 years of how we can get the legal and constitutional system to think about disability equal protection the same way it thinks about equal protection in the context of race or sex, and how do we do that, that suggests to me the way we do that is not actually by writing a brief that says that today, right? That may be part of it. But the most significant part of it is getting changes in the world, creating integrated communities that create an example and create political pressure and power for the disability rights movement. Okay, so that leads me to the question of who's our audience? If we're thinking about changing the attitudes of the legal system toward equal protection and disability, who are we thinking about? Who are we trying to win over? Well, ultimately, sure, courts. But if we think about courts, again, in the short to medium term, courts are going to be very conservative. So I saw Eve Hill around. I don't see her anymore. But I know she's – oh, there she is. She's hiding in the corner. Eve Hill, you know, gave terrific testimony at the Neil Gorsuch hearings, I really commend it to all of you. Presuming that Neil Gorsuch is the fifth vote on the Supreme Court, which is the new fifth member of the conservative majority on the Supreme Court, we know from Eve's testimony, but also from his record generally, also from just what it means to be that kind of a conservative jurist these days, we know this is not going to be a very friendly Supreme Court to disability issues. We know this is, if you want to think, I think of Garrett as just an incredibly horrible decision. I think it's terrible in so many ways. One of the ways in which it's terrible is it takes the Cleburne decision, which is a confusing decision. It's an ambiguous decision. It's a decision with multiple strands that point in different directions, and it completely fails to take seriously any of the parts of the Cleburne decision that provide robust protection against discrimination on the basis of disability. Just totally blows that off, and it does so in, a fairly dishonest way. It said, well, they were applying the ordinary rules of rational basis. That's the footnote that Chief Justice Rehnquist drops. No, that's not what they were doing, and everybody knows that's not what they were doing. And even if Justice White wrote an opinion that could be read that way if you only looked at half of it, you can't only look at half of it. We need to change Garrett, but the court tomorrow, or the court in a few weeks, once the filibuster is invoked and blown up and Neil Gorsuch is seated on the Supreme Court, is going to be a more conservative court than the court that decided Garrett, right? And I think that's very important to note. Who was in the majority in the Garrett case? Well, it wasn't just Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was, actually slightly to the left of Chief Justice Roberts, who replaced him, surprisingly enough. But also Justice O'Connor, who was way to the left of Justice Alito, who replaced her. I grew up in a world where Rehnquist and O'Connor were sort of the model of a very conservative jurist, and we keep moving to the right. Gorsuch is going to be a person who's going to be exactly where Scalia was on this stuff. So in the near term, the expectation that there is a change in the Supreme Court's doctrine is not something that I would expect at all. And remember my theory of constitutional change, which again is not just my theory, is that the Supreme Court is not the place we're going to find success in the first instance ever. Now, some of this, there will be opportunities in lower courts, but of course, anytime a lower court steps out too far, the Supreme Court can slap them down. We want to be very careful about thinking about what are generative ways of promoting these issues. So pushing issues too far too fast and getting slapped down can lead to very enervating kinds of losses, right? Losses where we really sap our energy. What we want to do is be building energy. We want to be building success. Therefore, I would suggest being extremely wary at this point in our nation's judicial history of rushing to court with sort of avant-garde equal protection claims. I know there's a theory out there that because the Supreme Court has been moving forward in areas like sexual orientation, that this creates an opening to go back to the expansion of rights that we were seeing toward the end of the Warren Court and maybe even early in the Berger Court. And my basic theory about this is a couple of things. One, that is very different than disability in terms of the degree of societal acceptance, right? So the bottom-up theory has worked much better for sexual orientation than for disability, and therefore the job for the disability rights movement is to think about how to do the societal acceptance and embrace and inclusion much better and much more strongly. And, you know, and in part that's because disability is fighting against something that's much harder, right? Disability is fighting against cost issues. Disability is fighting against, you know, what a number of scholars have talked about as a kind of existential dread or anxiety. So non-disabled people are much more likely to have an aversive reaction to disability than to things like sexual orientations that differ from theirs, and that's just a much harder nut to crack. But those are the nuts that need to be cracked before getting to the Supreme Court. I'll also say about the sexual orientation analogy. Not only is there a big difference in terms of societal attitudes, there is a big difference in terms of the attitudes of one person who matters very much, and that is Anthony Kennedy. We had some opportunity, if the Garland nomination had been allowed to come to a vote, if we hadn't had this historic and, you know, really historic obstruction of the power of a president to nominate a Supreme Court justice, we had the possibility that we wouldn't be living in Anthony Kennedy's world anymore. Guess what? We still live in Anthony Kennedy's world. And in Anthony Kennedy's world, sexual orientation, right, that's just normal human difference, and we embrace people across the spectrum. Disability remains very different. Disability is something we respond to with charity. We respond to with, as he said, the better angels of our nature, right? If you remember his concurring opinion in the Garrett case, where he said, yeah, you know, I'm a really good guy. I'm saying that that the ADA does not, in fact, enforce equal protection of the laws. I'm not allowing you to enforce the ADA against states in any meaningful way. But don't worry, because we all have to think really hard about how we can be nice to people who are lesser than ourselves, right? That's his frame, okay? He's the person whose world we're living in. So courts, short term, I'm nervous. Okay. I'm always a downer. I know I'm always a downer. It's amazing to me. I always get invited. I get invited back to this thing a lot, but there are a lot of places I actually get invited to speak at once, and then I give my downer speech. Don't worry, everyone else. I know everyone else in this room is going to be more of an upper. So I'm just going to be a downer. So legislatures, agencies, states, local governments. I think those are good policy levers to be pulling, and those are good areas to be pulling policy levers in. I think that to me, what's far more important than thinking about doing this within the frame of constitutional doctrine and constitutional equal protection doctrine in particular is to get the practices of states, of localities, of big institutions in the world, and I don't mean residential institutions, I mean institutions like the way a sociologist would talk about it, you know, folks coming together to do particular things, get those practices to be reflective of our understanding of what it means to have equality in the context of disability, right? So all of the advocacy everybody in this room does every day, you should think about as advocacy to overturn the unequal protection that people with disabilities receive in our law, right? And it's important to think about it that way and to talk about it that way, right? So there may be all kinds of different doctrinal bases for the claims that you're bringing. NFB had a nice victory in a case involving misclassification of workers in a sheltered workshop this year, right, at the Department of Labor. That was a very technical case about what 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act means. But you know what? That was also a case about equal protection of disabled people under the law. And I think it's important to always be talking about it that way. One of the things that the disability rights movement needs to do, I don't think, is go into court and try to get the court to overturn Garrett. They're not going to do it right away. What I think the disability rights movement needs to do is make clear that all the stuff that we're doing, when we're talking about the settings rule for HCBS waivers, that's about the equal protection of the laws. That's about treating people who have disabilities as equal to everybody else in society, right? That's saying everybody is an equal member of our society, and that's the way that we should be talking about it. That's the way constitutional change happens. We get enough success with those kinds of advocacy, then 10 years from now, you know, the constitutional change will be easy. And that's the goal. And also, talking about it in terms of the public, and with the public as your audience. And we've seen this some in campaigns against legalization of assisted suicide, obviously an issue on which there are differences of opinion within as well as outside of the disability community. But among disability rights advocates, and I would say, you know, it's probably most of the active, engaged disability rights advocates have been opponents of assisted suicide, of legalizing assisted suicide, and the frame has very much been a frame of equal protection of the laws, if you think about it, right? I mean, the way people talk about it in politics, generally you get very quickly into abortion politics, and that's often very uncomfortable for disability rights advocates who are very, you know, who tend to be very strongly pro-choice, again, differences of opinion in this community on that issue as well, but tend to be very strongly pro-choice with respect to abortion and don't want these issues to be thought of the same. And so disability rights advocates who have opposed assisted suicide legalization have said, look, think about it in terms of equality. I think this is, you know, my old friend, many of our old friends, Paul Miller, you know, wrote essentially this. If you are a person who wants to kill yourself, who doesn't have a disability, what we try to do as a society is stop you. Right? We have suicide hotlines. We have all kinds of efforts to provide you what you need to be living a life that is a life that you want to be living. And what does society do if you have a disability? Well, this is what Paul Miller said. You know, it's, well, fine. You know, go ahead. We'll help you out. And that is equal, unequal protection of the law in a very core sense is what Paul said, and that's the argument you see from disability rights advocates here, and I think you can see that in other places. I think this kind of argument can be made to the public in other places, right? So, I mean, if we're thinking, you know, so one area that's become very big and an important area of coalition between the disability rights movement and other social movements is police shootings, right? Where you have, I mean, so the Black Lives Matter movement has we're in you know, Baltimore, obviously one of the epicenters of the Black Lives Matter movement, and one of the things the Black Lives Matter movement has done so well is focus attention on inequalities of police use of force and inequalities with regard to race, but there are also massive inequalities with regard to disability, right? Different estimates, but you know, between a quarter and a half of all police deadly force incidents involve people with psychiatric disabilities, right? There's no good data on this. It's one of the problems there's no good data on this. But among the estimates, that's about the estimate. That's all police uses of force. And, of course, other kinds of disabilities are also significantly in the mix here. So this is an area where you can see using the idea of disability equal protection as a mobilizing tool and as a tool for appealing to the public. And again, this is how constitutional change happens. I think too often in our society, people outside of rooms like this and outside of, you know, independent living centers and ADAPT meetings and the loci of the disability rights movement, people outside of those places think about disability still as not being about equality, as not being about equal protection of the laws, but as about being nice to people, about doing well for people who are lesser than yourselves, an idea totally antithetical to the idea of equality. I think about the last presidential campaign, right? And we all know, you know, the Donald Trump Serge Kovalevsky incident, right, where Donald Trump makes fun of Serge Kovalevsky and then denies he did it. And you see the ad that Hillary Clinton ran immediately after that, right? And what was the ad? It was the, and I see Dr. Maurer's getting up, which means I'm about to get the hook. What was the ad that Hillary Clinton ran after that? It was an ad that featured a person with a disability only as a child who didn't speak. The first time you see her, you see her in a NICU, in an incubator, in a neonatal intensive care unit. The only people who speak are her parents, and all they talk about is how mean Donald Trump was. There's no sense of equality. There's no sense of everybody being equal. And that's the thing we need to change. And only if we change that is the constitutional doctrine going to change. And that's what I have to say. Thank you very much.
So if I have as many questions for Sylvia as I have for you, Sam, I don't know whether we're going to get done in time. But Sylvia Yee is at Disability Rights Education Defense Fund. She came from Canada, so maybe she can tell us what the difference is between Canadian and American jurisprudence or something. You get about, you know, a few minutes for that. But let's concentrate here on the 14th Amendment again. And she's been in an international, doing international work as well as doing the basic work at the Disability Rights Education Defense Fund. So here's Sylvia.
Thank you, Governor Moore. And thank you, Sam. In 2001, I know I'm going back a ways, Arlene and I wrote the article, The ADA and Models of Equality, and that examined the differences in approach between the equal opportunity framing of equality that underlies the ADA and the narrower formal equality of treatment that is used in U.S. constitutional analysis. We'll just treat you all the same. That's equality. And so from that, you saw intent has become a necessary element of inequality legal analysis, and disability discrimination requires irrational behavior. So in the article, we contrasted this approach with a human rights approach that is taken in international law and the constitutional analysis in the Supreme Court of Canada, which took a very deliberate step away from the intent requirements of U.S. constitutional law and recognized that under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, disadvantaged groups may need a benefit to enjoy equality. Now, since that 2001 article and when I started working at DREDF in 2000, there have been a number of changes, obviously. Two changes which are particular to what I'm going to speak of here, besides me just getting older. And also, here I'm going to stop and say this was intended to be an appearance by Arlene and myself. And Arlene was going to cover a lot of the 14th Amendment analysis because she's brilliant at that. Instead, I'm here to offer you her great apologies for not being able to come. She was quite ill earlier this month with pneumonia and dehydration, et cetera. And while she is definitely on her way and recovering, her doctor directly told her that she should not be traveling. So even though she was really looking forward to being here with you and to sharing her brilliance with you, I was tasked with being here alone. So, and so I'm speaking more. I'm the icing on Sam's cake today. So please just look at it that way.
It's a cake that needs some icing.
It's a really filling carrot cake. So one of the most critical things I want to say is that the UN actually passed, the UN and its member states passed the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the CRPD, in 2006, which is over 10 years ago, amazingly. Right now, the CRPD has 160 signatories and 172 ratifications, and the difference comes because some regions or country groups signed on, and then the individual members still have to ratify themselves. There are 92 signatories and ratifications to the optional protocol, which allows the CRPD committee to directly hear complaints from individuals within the ratifying states. So in case there is any question, the U.S. did sign the CRPD in July 2009. I think it was also on honoring the ADA anniversary. But it has not yet ratified the treaty. And I think it's unlikely to do so despite the campaign promises of the current president. Just testing if you're listening. And the second thing is that since 2001, I've actually had the great privilege of traveling to a number of other countries, specifically to help them develop, strengthen, and implement their domestic disability rights laws. So DREDF, in coalition with Mobility International USA and led by Mayusa, along with the U.S. International Council on Disabilities and the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, are part of the Rights Now project. And it's a project that's actually funded by the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor at the U.S. Department of State. We are operating in 6 countries. They are Armenia, Kenya, Mexico, and Vietnam, with Guatemala and Peru added just last year. The stated purpose of the project is to bring learnings and technical assistance to other countries, all of whom have signed and ratified the CRPD. The most recent ratification was Vietnam in 2015. But these are all countries who are struggling to get disability rights laws operational. This experience has been eye-opening, and it's eye-opening for seeing great similarities in the movement, in the struggle, and also great differences in the experience of the law and in how inequality is viewed, and in the necessity for the rule of law and how the rule of law operates in these different countries. So this is actually what I'm here to speak about. As mentioned, I'm from Canada. I got my law degree from Canada. I'm not going to offer you great insights into your constitution, which I did not study in law school. But I do think there are really interesting things to learn from what's going on around the world. So the convention, the CRPD, is undoubtedly, it's a material equality approach. It's not formal equality in any way. It focuses on outcomes. And it takes a human rights approach that assumes the fundamental equality and worth of all persons. It's not based on citizenship. It's not based on legal status. It's based on birth within the species, if you want to look at it as broadly as that. So there are 8 guiding principles that underlie the CRPD. And I think it's really interesting to listen to these in relation to what you know of the 14th Amendment and what cases have said about it. So the 8 guiding principles. First, respect for inherent dignity, individual autonomy, including the freedom to make one's own choices and independence of persons. 2, non-discrimination. That's just one of the principles. 3, full and effective participation and inclusion in society. 4, respect for difference and acceptance of persons with disabilities as part of human diversity and humanity. 5, equality of opportunity. 6, accessibility, which is independent from non-discrimination. 7, equality between men and women. And 8, respect for the evolving capacities of children with disabilities and respect for the right of children with disabilities to preserve their identities. The CRPD evolved over a process of work for a number of years with participants from all over the world. And you can see the benefit of that, that this is a convention that really was worked on by the community, by all over the world. And they bring with them their experience and their understanding of what does it mean to be equal? What are the things we need to be at the table and to be accepted as equal? So like all international law, the CRPD is aspirational, of course, and it can also be galvanizing. So ratification of the CRPD requires reconciliation of a country's domestic laws with the aspirations of the treaty. It can take place over time, but as Sam has mentioned, really critical changes in law take place over time. The cases may seem to come and affect immediate change, but you don't get the decisions without change over time. In a way, the CRPD becomes a lens, somewhat like a constitution, through which a country's laws can be interpreted. Of course, different countries take the obligation differently. I'm going to talk a little bit about Mexico, a little more about Guatemala, and if I have time at the end, a bit about Armenia. I have been in Mexico in October of 2015. I was in Guatemala in October of last year and will be going there again in May. And Armenia, I have not been there, but I looked pretty closely at their current law, their new law on people with disabilities, which, well, it's a bill. It's been a bill for many, many, many years, but it's been evolving through that time as well. So Mexico signed the CRPD and ratified it quite quickly early on. It's coming up on its second reporting period, and there's a lot of activity there. I think some of the chief issues in Mexico at the time, which we're hearing about constantly, is coalition building. The U.S. Bureau, the State Department, does reports on other countries' human rights. And so Mexico does have a disability rights law. It prohibits discrimination against persons with physical, sensory, intellectual, and mental disabilities in employment, education, air travel, and other transportation, access to health care, the judicial system, and the provision of other services. And this is one short sentence in the country reports. The government did not effectively enforce the law. Okay. So there is...
What a surprise.
Yeah. There is inaccessibility. Children with disabilities are not consistently educated. What we've gotten a lot from Mexico is that the difficulty of forming long-standing coalitions, long-standing cross-disability coalitions. Human rights and some disability rights groups are very, very focused on deinstitutionalization, which is a critical issue there. The broader issues of accessibility, of employment are known, but it's just difficult to form long-lasting coalitions, it seems. And every time we go there are these issues of community, of who's sort of in charge. And probably international funding doesn't help. It doesn't help in the way that it's sort of given out or meted out in certain ways. And so then it becomes competitive as well. And it's hard. I don't know of a really strong national Mexican disability rights leadership group or coalitions that have stood for long periods that are national. It doesn't mean that there are not really interesting things going on locally, or that there aren't these activities and changes in municipal laws, et cetera, that are happening. But it is at a local level, so or a regional level. So you see in one country how the strategy has been really to, and in many of these countries, the strategy is to work locally, to make changes where you can, to get your kids into your local school, and to make those to get your mayor to make changes while you're friends with him and before the next mayor comes along. So that happens a lot. In Guatemala, which has been on my mind a lot since I was there recently and I'm going to go again, there's some really interesting activities there as well. There's a current law happening. There's a 1996 law in Guatemala, a disability law. I wouldn't necessarily call it a disability rights law, or you might call it that, but there are no implementation mechanisms. So it's hard to see it as a disability rights law. So it's been on the books for a long time. Right now, there is a new law being drafted that is currently passing through, and it's an interesting process. It had its last reading recently, and apparently the last reading is where all the changes can take place. So despite sort of sailing through two readings, this is now where the negotiations are really going to happen. And it's fascinating to be in touch with a lawyer there who actively worked on the law, on its drafting, and who has also been working on a disability rights case there. She said that we are at a time when the discussion is open again, as there are doubts regarding the benefits of the law, including tax exemptions and bonuses for personal assistance for employees with disabilities. It's kind of fascinating to see how disability rights laws in other countries have taken lessons from the CRPD. I mean, think of it, a bonus for personal assistance being written into a disability rights law. I mean, it's a reality for many people with disabilities that you work and you need personal assistance, and it costs but it's not necessarily taken account of. And that that some of the that the business sector is sort of coming awake to the fact that they may have what they call customer service obligations arising under the law. So these things are all happening, and they're actively working on it. There is a disability discrimination case, the very first one that was won in Guatemala, apparently, brought in Guatemala City, and it was won in March by this same lawyer, Flor. She was representing a plaintiff, William Zepeda, who is a blind individual with a guide dog and who was denied access to the Maya Excelsior Hotel in Guatemala City. So if you're going, don't stay there. The facts were first presented to a judge on January 20th, and then the case in 2015, and then the case was heard, and I love Google translation, was heard in the Pluripersonal Court of Criminal Peace. I don't think that's what it was, but I do not have Spanish, and she has a certain limited English, so that I'm just letting you know. So it was continuance is granted. It was heard on February 3rd of this year, and then I think it's really interesting to look at what she brought her case under, because the new law is not law yet. I don't think she even touched the 1996 disability law. She used a criminal code, which a discrimination offense, which is under the criminal code in Guatemala. Any distinction, exclusion, restriction, or preference based on gender, race, ethnicity, language, age, religion, economic status, disability, marital status, or any other reason, circumstance, or circumstances that impedes or hinders a person, group of persons, or associations from the exercise of a legally established right. So I have noticed that in translation, sometimes Spanish has more words than when I'm speaking in English, and so that might explain this too. But her primary argument was based on a criminal code offense for which there was a fine. A fine of 300,000 quetzales, the Guatemalan unit of money, and the penalty can be increased by one-third under certain circumstances. Her second line of argument was based on the CRPD, because it is a law approved in Guatemala, and it is superior, it is above any internal commercial legislation. So Article 20 concerns animals, assistance animals, and so she used that as well. The third was control of conventionality, which is a principle established by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. So it's a regional human rights law that she used. And then there's a fourth, which she called the constitutionality block. I'm not entirely sure what that is, and I'm just So Guatemala is a civil law system. All of the countries that we've been working in are civil law systems, actually, primarily. I mean, there's a mix out there in the world, but so she used codes and achieved a victory. The decision came down for William Zepeda, and it was greatly celebrated because, to really get across, this is the first disability rights case in Guatemala. It wasn't just a complaint that was resolved privately between the parties, which happens often, apparently. Many people with disabilities in Guatemala are often poor. Mediation is kind of a requirement, apparently, before going to court, and there's a settlement very early on for many of these cases. So this was a deliberate decision by the disability community, with a lawyer helping them, to move forward with a case. And that also, again, is part of what Sam is talking about, this kind of, the law, not necessarily the Supreme Court decisions or the constitutional decisions, but bringing these cases at a level where you can make known what equality means, where it becomes clear to people that it's our right to enter into hotel rooms and to bring the animals we need with us. And this is part of changing the consciousness of a country, part of changing the consciousness of a judiciary. And it was a risk, even at that initial level, but it was one they took and they won. So in Guatemala, it's this fascinating mix, because you go in the streets and everything is inaccessible. Every person I know there who uses a mounted wheelchair is very good at doing those hopping, you know, when you pop your wheelie and you get onto sidewalks, because you can't get anywhere without it. They had a larger, more systemic transportation case earlier in Guatemala City, where they tried to get the new transportation system being built across the city accessible. What happened was that they decided that, okay, your stations can be accessible. We'll have a ramp going up. But the stations in Guatemala City are often in the medians, with streams of traffic going on either side. And there's no accessible way between to get to the median. So that's sort of the reality of what you're dealing with. And you don't see people with disabilities on the street very often. That's another critical component in many countries, where disability is still hidden. Right? Let's see. So I wanted to just briefly, it looks like I'll be able to look, whether I wanted to talk briefly about Armenia as a contrast again, because they had this new bill that they've been looking at for a long time. I think one of the reasons for our article in 2001 was that Arlene really wanted to share with the world and countries who are embarking on this sort of disability rights journey and writing laws. She wanted to let them know more about the ADA and about this conflict that between the ADA and its understanding that you need equality of opportunity and the constitutional understanding of it. And she wanted to let them know about it because she saw the world as having an opportunity to start afresh in some ways, in other countries, you know, to start from scratch, to write new laws from scratch. But that's never really the truth. Other countries, of course, have their own history, their understanding of disability, their own constitutional legacy, and their own understanding of welfare and of disability. And Armenia is such a striking example of that, because in their law, you have words that get across disability rights to some extent. There are laws that illustrate, yes, there are violations of rights. People have the right to be employed. They have the right to education, their right to accessibility. But it's in the same law that continues to talk about three levels of disability status that have to be approved by the government, because that's how welfare is distributed. And because it's also mixed up, you think, well, do you actually have to have a government disability status to bring a disability rights complaint? How do you disentangle those three things? If disability is only understood through a lens of welfare and of official sanctioned status, how do you get to true disability rights? And that was one thing that the ADA was very, very clear about. It was absolutely, this is not about welfare, this is not about benefits, this is about rights. And so, I mean, I think in all these reflections, you know, why am I talking about all of these things? some of it is really just to provide a certain level of encouragement, in fact, that you see these struggles all over the world, that you've brothers and sisters with disabilities that are fighting to become a community, that are fighting for political understanding and awareness and influence. In some countries, they are facing what could be called a first generation problem here, accessibility in the streets. But the root cause is the same, and the need for people with disabilities, the understanding of the community as the first and the last line of defense in the fight for rights is absolutely critical. And I think that's what Sam is getting at as well in many of these, in what he's saying, that ultimately it's rooted in people with disabilities, the understanding of their rights, the understanding of what disability is, and the understanding of what equality is. And it's the community that has ultimately the responsibility of getting the rest of the world to see that. And lawyers will be your allies. In the rest of the world, the per capita number of lawyers per population is much lower than in the United States. So lawyers will be allies, but they're not as readily available in many parts of the world as they are here. But it's really the community. And that is the understanding of equality that has to inform any judicial decision, any Supreme Court decision. And it won't be through the case reporter that happens. It will be in the interactions with judges in their lives, with their judges' children, with where they are in the streets. That's what I see. And what people understand more, I think, sometimes in other parts of the world. They still need a law. And the ADA was this, I still think it's the swiftest way, the most detailed way that I've ever seen, the most effective tool of getting people with disabilities their rights quickly and effectively in detail on the streets, out. So they're in the schools, they're in the workplace. But then there's still so much to be done after that.
Thank you, Sylvia. And Luann, are you there, Luann?
Yeah.
Somewhere there's supposed to be a microphone that roves in this place, yes?
Right here.
You've got it. In other words, we can take questions, and please, the nature of this is to identify yourself, and you get recognized when you identify yourself, please. Otherwise, I get to ask Sam all the questions. Any questions for Sam or Sylvia? No? Well, all right. I've got one for you, Sam.
Okay.
The language, it strikes me, of the Americans with Disabilities Act has troubles, and the interpretation of it, therefore, has troubles, which is to say, disability is always thought of in the Act as a thing that might cause undue burden. And so burden is part of the language, and accommodation is part of the language. And what can be done to change the nature of the thinking? When, by the way, I don't think you're a downer in one sense. You said that in 10 years we're going to have a change. If it only takes 10 years, I'll be glad. So don't worry too much. But the thing is that the language of the cases, the language of the Act, talks about accommodation, meaning that we're doing something for you, and then it talks about burden. And those things are very closely associated with disability, so instead of having somebody walk into a room who's got a disability and somebody else says, oh, good, we got somebody here with a disability, they all think, oh, no, what do we do now? Here comes the burden. And, you know, how do we change this thinking process?
Yeah, I think that's in some ways the ultimate question here. You know, and I think it's not just the language of the ADA, although the language of the ADA is very much about that. It is the way people in society think about disability, and I think, and even judges. So this past week, it's been a long week for me. It feels long ago. But on Monday or Tuesday, the Supreme Court issued a decision in a death penalty case involving a person with an intellectual disability. And if you read, you know, Justice Ginsburg's opinion for the court saying that Texas shouldn't have been able to condemn this person to death, right, very liberal, progressive decision, her understanding of disability, and she's probably the best there is on the Supreme Court on this stuff, her understanding of disability is all about all the stuff you're talking about, Dr. Maurer. It's all about deficit. It's all about, you know, what makes what, and even she says you shouldn't look, the Texas courts got it wrong, to look at all the things this guy could do. What you have to look at when you're thinking about disability is deficit. Now, obviously, that's a very particular context, and there's a lot more going on, but I think it's indicative of a general view in society about what disability is. And I think you're exactly right. The biggest change, the biggest thing that will lead to change here is to change that perception. And part of it is, I mean, so part of it is policy, right? I mean, I think to the extent that we have policies that don't put the cost of accommodation on a particular employer or a particular entity that that feels like they have an incentive to turn away people with disabilities, treat people with disabilities as others, that's helpful. But beyond that, I think there's also just a need for a massive change in the way we think about the way the world thinks about stuff. And, you know, 10 years, look, I that was my optimistic moment, so thank you. I'm getting to an age where I can only think 10 years ahead, you know. When I was younger, I could think 30 years ahead. Now 10 years is all I got. So.
You can't buy green bananas anymore, right?
Exactly.
Sylvia, you have thoughts about this question?
I think the ADA's concept of reasonable accommodation has been adopted all over the world. It's just an understanding that people with disabilities need a change in the way things are done. And I think that, I mean, I guess it's changing the perception that change itself is a burden, is always a burden, a change in how you do things. And to a degree, it is. I don't know how to soften it so that it's not recognized. People who benefit from the way things are done now are always going to be burdened when you change it. I think it's trying to get people to recognize that it's a good benefit. It's a benefit that ultimately is good for everyone, but it means change. And so I'm not sure how to. I certainly wouldn't. I could not. Like take away the idea of reasonable accommodation and how it's needed.
Well, let me just say one thing about this. Actually, it reminds me of one thing that you know. I mean, I think the equality way of thinking about all this is, you know, we have a world that was designed for and by a set of people with a set of, you know, physical characteristics and other kinds of characteristics. They designed the world for themselves. I mean, it's not surprising, for example, that this building is designed in a very different way than the rest of Baltimore is, right, because of who was designing it and who they were thinking about. And rectifying that may involve a cost when considered against the baseline of the status quo, and that's the thing people are focusing on, but it doesn't mean it, you know, all it's doing is it's restoring a state of equality we should have had before. And just the one brief example I'll give, I have seen, because Justice Ginsburg showed it to me, the memo that Irwin Griswold, the longtime dean of the Harvard Law School, wrote explaining why it would be too burdensome to admit women to the Harvard Law School because they used to not admit women. And the memo said, look, we would have to install women's bathrooms, and it costs out the women's bathrooms. So it's a perfect example. Now, obviously, everybody now, bathrooms have become like a more fraught thing, but everybody now understands that this is not a cost of women, right? This is just equal access. This is treating women as the same, as having the same rights and opportunities as men. And we have to get to the point where we think about disability in the same way. We think about a world where there are only men's rooms is not an equal neutral baseline, and same with a world that's not accessible to people with all kinds of disabilities.
So now, everybody needs accommodation. It isn't just the handicapped or the disabled or whatever we call them nowadays. There have been a lot of names for this crowd, you know. Back after the Civil War, known as the invalids. But that's the American Civil War. It happened in the 1860s, in case you want to know. So there have been a lot of names. But everybody's accommodated. Look at all the lights we got around here. I don't need those things. What do we put them in here for? Well, we put them in here for a lot of you guys who don't know how to manage without them, you know? We need them. And what are we doing at the moment? We're rebuilding this place so that we can get more windows in it, because somehow that's important. To me, not so much. But to a lot of people. I mean, accommodation for every soul on the planet. You wouldn't need a bathroom in the place at all if we didn't have people in it. But here we go. We got all these... What we built the building so people could be in it, and that means we accommodate everybody that walks in the place, or rolls in, or however you get in. So this thing about how it is that we only talk about accommodation when the disabled are involved, this annoys me, and that right next to it is this thought of burden. They would build it right in and say there's a burden. Well, yeah, there's a burden, sure. Everybody causes a burden. Now, there are other things to talk about. Anybody else have questions? I know I've made my speech.
Couple.
All right, who wants to floor?
Hi, Jim Falakis.
Yes, sir.
Sam, in 1991, I was at a graduation party for a young woman at Columbia, and I happened to meet her uncle Tony, who turned out to be Anthony Kennedy. There were 20 people in a men's club that managed to let women in for the event because Uncle Tony was a member. He sought me out in this room. We spent about 3 hours, primarily just the two of us, chatting. There were drinks, scotch, cigars involved. He was incredibly engaging, didn't talk about himself or things much. He was asking me questions. And in one of the most intense conversations I've ever had, we talked a lot about healthcare. I was pre-med at the time. He was curious about the discussion that was going on in politics on that. But he wanted to know, I wanted to be a doctor, how I might accomplish that, what I would need to do. Why doesn't he get it? Why, several years later, why don't the other justices get it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so it's true, right? So if you meet Justice Kennedy, he's a very engaging guy. He a curious person, but he has a set of views about the world. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think this is something. Again, we thought maybe we weren't going to have to figure this out, but now we do again. So I don't know the answer to that. But it's a really interesting. I mean, it's not that anybody on the court is incapable of understanding these issues. It is simply that they see the world in a very different way, and how to change that worldview, I think, is hard and takes place over time.
Somebody else has a question.
Yes, my name is Michelle Willett, and I'm an attorney, but I'm here more as a mom, actually. And I listened with interest to what you had to say, and I think perhaps all the attorneys and lawyers and people in this room, when they're practicing, would it be helpful, you think, to try at the very community level and at the, first line court level, try to establish a separate legal standard. And my daughter is blind. But rather than saying the reasonable man, is it possible to promulgate something like the reasonable blind man and to try to get that concept into the legal lexicon and that sort of thing? Because people do get it if you sit and talk with them one-on-one. It's just when they get into the courtrooms and they get into the precedents and they get into what they were taught in law school that sort of gets clouded because they've put on their professional hat. If you explain, like she's in school, she's in a very demanding scientific curriculum, and when you talk to the professor and say, look, she can't get this figure of a hand and an extremity on a test because she's never seen it before, then it's like, oh, I just didn't think about that. So if you can maybe try to establish an equal with no burden attached, but simply a blind reasonable standard or a wheelchair reasonable standard or something like that that talks the legal language and the lingo. And the other is just a comment. I have found over watching my daughter over the past 10 years that if anybody in here is designing anything, and the only person who understood this was Bill Gates, design it for the blind. If the blind can do it easily, everyone else can do it so much more easily, and the marketplace simply opens. I mean, look at Siri. Who wants to drive? Who wants to type? The blind have a extraordinarily valuable leverage if they would just learn how to exploit that with industries anywhere. Because if you guys can do it easily, the rest of us, it's something we would rather have, and we would rather do our work and our day-to-day living in this manner if it can accommodate someone who's blind.
So, Sam and Sylvia?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I mean, first of all, on that last issue, I think NFB has just done an enormous job of providing leadership on those issues of getting companies that engage in technological development to think of blind people as a central part of the folks they're designing for. Dr. Maurer's, you know, incredible leadership when he was the head of NFB, and it's continued. So I think that's really important. Thinking about the, what's the right legal framework to think about this? You know, so reasonable blind person makes me think of Jacobus Tenbroek's article, The Right to Live in the World on Disability and Torts, which is really all about how tort law, I mean, this is in the 1960s. This is probably the first article about disability rights law ever, before we had a term disability rights law. And you know, thinking about the way that courts think about disability, and in that case, you know, he was very much motivated by his own experience as a blind person. And what he sort of the takeaway I always got from that article was, look, to fail to think about the disability of the person who is involved in the case is a problem, but to think that people have a lesser right to go about the world or have lesser standards applied to them because of the disability is also a problem, right? So it's really framing very nicely the fundamental questions of disability rights law that we're still working out. I like to think, I mean, when we're talking about issues like tests or we're talking about all kinds of accommodation issues, I think what the accommodation duty does is it forces all of us, but it particularly forces the folks who set up rules or physical structures or whatever to think, well, why do I have this thing? Like, why do I have this test that asks, can you draw a hand, right? Is it because I think that to really understand this subject, you need to draw a hand, or because I just haven't thought of any other way to test on the subject? You know, so why, you know, taking a different disability context, why do we have one-hour tests? Is it because we really think people need to answer questions in an hour and that's telling us something about them? Or is it because, you know what, class times last for an hour. It's easier to administer one-hour tests, right? And so the accommodation duty really forces us to think about what are we trying to do, and is the way we're achieving the thing we're trying to do excluding people who shouldn't be excluded, who really are equal with regard to the thing that we're really trying to do? And I think that's a fundamental question here. So I see Susan has it.
Hi, this is Susan Silverstein. I'm from AARP Foundation.
You're the last one, because we're about to run out of time. So okay. Go for it, Susan.
From AARP Foundation Litigation, although I will say that what I'm going to say next, I'm not saying in any official capacity, probably has nothing to do with the law. It's probably more analogous to the fact that I've worn out my angry button on Facebook over the last few months, which I'm not exactly sure how you can do, but I'm sure that I've done it. And I think that this follows up on what both of you were saying about, you know, the legal framework has become very much a, you know, how do we go in there defensive about, you know, how is this not a fundamental alteration? How are we going to defend that it's a reasonable accommodation? But following up on what the doctor was saying, I mean, Nina Cohn has several articles on elder law as a civil right. And obviously, this is stating the obvious. You know, we go back to the roots of disability law as a civil rights movement. But this is really founded on the right of our bodies to be in the same space as every other body, you know, whether you have legs or don't have legs, or see or don't see. And I think it's really important for us to carry that into our legal work. And even if we're making arcane legal arguments or talking about precedent, there are always going to be the people who are going to look at it from the corporate side of, well, this is the way we've done our business, and you're asking us to make changes to our business. All of those business models came before the civil rights laws. I'm mostly a housing attorney, and I've been doing a lot of assisted living work. And the first thing I often say now when I sit down to a negotiation is to say that their assisted living model was a move forward or an invention, but it started it was put into place before 1988, and it has not adjusted to the new legal framework. So we're really going back, and we're reimposing a framework of equality on top of an industry that was there before, and it has to change. So, I mean, I think that we just have to go back to the fact that every single human being has a right to be in the marketplace, has a right to be in the community, and that these questions of accommodations are just the framework for how we start moving things along. But we can't forget the underlying premise, and I think that sometimes saying that to the court and reminding them that we're not asking for special treatment, we're asking for where we belong, and we're there to show them how the law is the framework for moving this along, and how Congress said was a fair way to make it happen since 1990. We're not here to debate whether it should or shouldn't happen.
I bet the panel members agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.